The following program has been pre-recorded. The views expressed by the participants are not necessarily those of WHFR Radio or Henry Ford College. Welcome to We Are Not Alone. We're local investigators, as well as world-renowned scientists and ufologists, share their latest evidence in support of the UAP reality. I'm David Twitchell, and for the next hour, we'll be exploring the mysteries of the UFO, UAP, and abduction phenomenon.
Our guest today is Mr. Steve Aspin, speaking with us from the United Kingdom. His new book, Out of Time, is Steve's first book on the subject of UFO and abduction research. Following a lifetime of what are often described as anomalous experiences, his serious interest in this complex subject began in 2007 when he realized that the phenomenon was not only real, but was happening to him and had been all of his life. He spent several years researching publications on the subject, met with many of the world's leading researchers into the phenomenon, and tried his best to make sense out of all of his own, just for his own peace of mind. He achieved this to some degree, and for several years chose to no longer engage with the issue. However, following some serious health issues and on the encouragement of those close to him, he decided to write about his experiences and thoughts on the phenomenon as he has come to understand it. The decision to go public is never an easy one for a person involved in something as unbelievable as alien abduction. And derision, disbelief, and denial are the common responses. But something is happening to people and needs to be addressed. Retired, without children, and with support of those closest to him, common obstacles that often inhibit people from speaking out are no longer factors in his life. So let's welcome to the show, Mr. Stephen Aspin. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hi, David. Thanks for inviting me on. Really, really pleased to be here.
I'm glad to have you all the way from the UK.
Indeed.
Of course, if people are listening to this in the UK, they'll say, what do you mean all the way from the UK? That's I'm right here. But anyway, now your book is more than 300 pages, so there's a lot of ground to cover. So let's start with what anomalous events you recall as a young child.
Yeah, excuse me. I recall being... having the same kind of nighttime incidents as a child that many, not all, but many abductees report. And in my case, I had absolutely no idea that these incidents that were happening to me at night had anything to do with alien life forms or UFOs or anything like that. And I just thought it was part of the natural world, like the occult world or the spirit world or something. The folklore and these little creatures that abducted me. I didn't use the word abducted when I was 7 or 8 years old, but came in and so that I was unable to move anything. I was paralyzed. It's a very physical sensation when you're not able to move. I just didn't know what this phenomenon was. And that was the main thing. That was a recurrent thing that happened once every few weeks. As far back as I can remember with certainty these incidents happening from 7 years old, and I think they almost certainly happened prior to that as well. So that's the first thing. Do you want to go on from there?
Yeah, I was going to ask you, to what do you attribute these nighttime intrusions in your child's mind?
Yeah, I thought, as I said, I thought it was something as part of the spirit world, or the natural unseen world, or the fairy worlds, something like that, because I had no sighting of an unidentified flying object or any interest in the phenomenon. This was in the 1950s, 1960s, until I was about in my teens. Well, about 11, I first came across UFOs as a serious academic subject. And prior to that, there were just things you found in comics, Charles comics, or sometimes in Hollywood movies, you know, like Lost in Space and so forth. Mm-hmm. That was all science fiction, basically. And I didn't really connect that to what was happening to me.
So you couldn't put that together, huh?
No, and it's very common for abductees to attribute the phenomenon initially to many other things, to the spirit world, to the Magonia stuff, you know, the stuff that's basically the fairy stories and folk tales and the pixies and things like that, and throughout the 20th century, when prior to the start of the space program, and prior to 1947, I think all abductees who became aware that something weird was happening to them, that was exceptionally strange, all abductees basically thought it was the part of the natural world, or the you know, the strange occult world that surrounded them. Mm.
Yeah, many have said that they thought, I know my sister is an abductee.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And
so it's in your family then?
It's in my family, yeah. And I had a sighting. I won't go into that because I've talked about that so many times to my listeners. But I recall being abducted once, before and the after, but not the middle. But my sister says she thought that, you know, this being drifted out of her bed and through a wall and up to a craft, as a child, she thought everybody went through this. So, you know what I'm saying?
It's very common for kids to feel that way and to say that. I thought it happened to everybody. I when I was 10 years old, or thereabouts, 10 or 11, I remember the house this abduction happened, and we lived there for 3 years during my 9, 10, 11 years old. I asked one of the abductors once why they were doing this to me, and it was I different to others, and why was this continue to happen to me? And one of them said to me, they speak to you telepathically in your mind, but you know, you can hear them in your head, and in a very bored, offhand sort of, you know, sort of way, he said, "Oh, it's because of your mother and your grandmother and your great grandmother," and then you just carried on with what he was doing, and that's. My grandmother, that at the time I saw about three times a year, because they lived a couple of hundred miles away from where we were at the time, and my parents worked full time. Mm-hmm. So we used to go down there school holidays. And the next time we visited my grandmother, I asked her about this, and I said, you know, I tried to describe these nighttime incidents. And she said, "Oh, Stevie, they're just the pixies. Don't worry, they'll always bring you back." And I think she just felt that it happened to some kids, maybe many kids, and you just had to explain to the child that it was the pixies or the fairies. and you just expect it to happen to you for the rest of your life. And you wouldn't worry about it because they always brought you back, and, you know, you basically, it was just part of life. You just had to accommodate it. That's the way she thought about it.
But did she ever express to you that she had been abducted?
Yes. I mean, she wouldn't have had that attitude had she not had the experience herself, because out of all my extended family, you know, as the family go back generations, you know, there's more and more of them, because obviously 4 grandparents and 8 great-grandparents and so forth. She's the only one I ever talked to about it. And this alien told me within weeks earlier to this conversation with my grandma, the alien told me, it's because of your mother and your grandmother and your great grandmother. This is why we're doing it to you. You're the next in the line. And actually, that's the cornerstone of my book, Out of Time, The Intergenerational Abduction Program Explored, is how I think this program, because it's a program involving millions of people, how it's structured and how it works. And the book is, there's a reason why I take up 300 pages to go into this, because it's relatively complicated, but it's actually, once you understand it, it's really not that hard to understand, but you have to work through the process. And I try and do that in the book. And the book is partly written for people who don't really know anything about the alien abduction program. They don't know anything. They think it's weird. And Ralph Blumenthal quoted somebody who said about the abduction program. He said, Ralph was investigating John Mack, as you know, written a book about John Mack, the Harvard psychiatrist. And he said, I don't claim that it's possible. I just claim that it's true.
What?
Which is exactly. And it is on surface of it, it is impossible. I mean, it's right. Not impossible. You have to say it's highly improbable that any of this is going on. But in fact, I've spoken to 30 or 40 abductees in the 15 years that I've been investigating this. And I've got to know some of them extremely well. And they all say that they realize how improbable the whole thing is and how outrageously unlikely it is. But nevertheless, it's happening to them. And that a lot of people take years and years and years to talk to anybody about it. And they won't discuss it with anybody because it's so damn unlikely. And I think since Leslie Kane, Ralph Blumenthal, and was it Helen? I can't remember the third journalist name. Brought the ATIP program into the public domain by publishing in the New York Times in December 2017. The UFO, that's or UAP, unidentified aerial phenomenon, subject has now got a newfound respectability because, you know, there are congressional hearings about it, and everything has been brought out into the open slowly by degrees. And it's in this environment, a lot of people have come to recognize that it's a legitimate thing that's actually going on in a big way. And all the military are involved and are aware of it. Military pilots are aware of it, and there are radar tracers, and this is a real thing. And therefore, introducing the abduction issue as a topic that links to that very strongly is now not so taboo as it might have been 20 or 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, more and more people are coming out with their experiences.
Even
the Pentagon, the Navy, and other institutions. Government and scientific institutions are coming out with that fact. Well, science, most of the scientists have known this for years, but they get grants from the government that would be cut off had they gone public with it. Am I right?
Yes, this is Jacques Vallée's Invisible College. idea from way back, you know, from the 70s. He wrote a book about this very issue and decades ago. And it's just true now as it's ever been.
Yes. I have to take a moment to remind our listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves, and you're listening to We Are Not Alone. I'm David Twitchell, your host, and we're speaking with researcher, author, and alien contactee, shall I say, abductee, or whatever he wants to call it, Mr. Steve Aspen. What do you want to call yourself? Contactee, experiencer?
Yeah, people use all those West expressions. John Mack was particularly fond of experiencer because it sounds like, you know, the people have this extraordinary, otherworldly, mystical experience. And it's less abductee sounds that you're being subjected to something and you have no choice over it. But to me, I use the word abductee throughout my book because that describes more accurately as exactly what's going on with people. Mm-hmm. We don't really have a choice about this, that those people who are selected for the program and involved in it. It is an intergenerational phenomenon. Yeah. It goes from parent to child to child to child, and we're in the fourth or fifth generation now. I think the program started in between 1890 and 1900, and I bring a lot of evidence in the book, in the later last two chapters, to support this contention. Mm-hmm. And I think the evidence is incontrovertible that this started in the 1890s, and there's a very specific and planned program going on.
Okay, now you mentioned that you are in bed and all of a sudden you find yourself being taken and you're paralyzed, you can't move, and psychologists like to say this is sleep paralysis. What do you say to that?
Well, the problem with this lazy, if I might say so, diagnosis is that a lot of abductions happen in the daytime when people are awake or driving cars.
Right.
And the character of the experience, the character of what happens to them is exactly the same. The reason the abductors take people at night a lot, probably more than in the daytime, is that they can gain access to the abductee. And the abductee doesn't have any recognized missing time. Your audience, I'm sure, will recognize the missing time elements as a very common, it's a universal element for this phenomenon. And I also go into the book in some detail as to exactly what missing time is. And exactly how it's engineered in the brain of the abductee. So there's just a gap in there. It's instantaneous. If you're awake, you're driving as an example, you'll notice some light. People report noticing a light in the sky and pulling over the side of the road to, quote, get a better look at it, unquote. Mm-hmm. And it's instantly, they notice the clock is 2 hours ahead of where it was a second ago. Mm-hmm. And they feel some really strange has happened. They feel that people had a very disturbing experience, and the light in the sky is receding and they're going away. There's a way that they can engineer this by staring into the abductee's eyes, connecting with the optic nerve, and playing around with your memories. And I explain in the book everything we know about how this is done. And I think when they take abductees at night when they're sleeping, there's no need to. Basically, the abductee doesn't notice the missing time thing because they just wake up in the morning and they just I had a weird dream last night. I just felt this and I remember that and they feel tired all day. Mm. Very often they complain of feeling tired all day. But they don't have any missing time element. So they don't have that strange feeling that something happened just then And I don't know where the time went, because if you're asleep in the dark, that doesn't apply. So that's one of the reasons I think they work at night a lot.
No, if you're asleep, you expect to have that missing time element. You know, I just went to sleep and I woke up.
8 hours.
Yeah, eight hours are gone.
So yeah.
Tell us about your missing time event in Norfolk in East Anglia.
I was, when I was 12. Yeah, I was a school friend. His parents invited me to go on holiday with him. He was an only child, I had a sibling, but he was an only child. We were schoolmates, and I was around his house all the time, and he was around my house all the time. And his parents invited me to go on holiday with them. So we went to Norfolk, towing a caravan. We lived at that time in Cheshire in northwest England. So Norfolk was about a day's drive across the country to the other side of the country. And in the middle of the week, we were in a street in Norwich, which is a medium-sized city, old city. And I was looking in a shop window, and the other three were just nearby. My friend, who I call Paul in the book, wasn't his real name, and his parents. And suddenly, they grabbed hold of me and screamed at me, "Where have you been? We've been looking all over for you. Where have you been?" And they explained eventually, when they started to calm down, that I disappeared completely for more than an hour. And they imagined I'd run off or hidden somewhere and then just come back really quickly. And so I was just missing from the group. And I had no memory at the time of what had happened, because I just, you know, and I didn't even realize that, you know, there was any missing time. So something happened to, I could make no sense of it. They could make no sense of it. They thought I was lying, I think, or was up to mischief, and their son's friend was maybe not to be completely trusted. And they didn't invite me to go on holiday with them again. But that missing hour was something that a number of abductees report instances like that, not exactly the same as that, but very, very similar to that. And that's something that I just never understood and didn't give it much thought, you know, in subsequent years, because it happened when I was 12. So by the time I was 20, I just really rarely or never thought about it, because, you know, it's just one of those things. You know,
so it would appear, and this has happened many times, reported by abductees, that they switched your friends off. They switched all of you off.
Well, yes.
Abducted you and then switched them back on once you returned.
That's common, but in this instance, that didn't happen. They were fully conscious and they were looking for me.
Okay.
Like Travis Walton, obviously, the Travis Walton case in Arizona in 1975. He had five or six witnesses, the other guys in the truck. I think it was the seven guys, including Travis and Mike Rogers. And they were all fully conscious and they weren't switched off. They drove off down the road and came back to look for Travis, and they didn't lose any time. They weren't shut down. But they just, so that they witnessed the abduction.
Right.
In that case.
So did your friends witness your abduction?
No, they didn't see anything. I just vanished. I mean, maybe they thought they were just looking the other way, and I just gone, which they just assumed that I'd run off or was hiding somewhere. Right.
So it's,
but I wasn't doing either of those things. You know, I wasn't even aware that I've been away, you know, that anyone had missed me, because I just thought it was in a second ago I was standing there, you know, but they had this hour of time when they couldn't find me.
Right. So they didn't switch you off. Okay.
No.
So describe the onset and aftermath of a typical abduction experience and the realization of the missing time accompanying it.
Well, what happens is an abductee, I'll use the word abductee because, you know, as I say, I think it's a little more precise a description as to what they're, rather than a contactee, which isn't really accurate, and experiencer, which, you know, is you know, if you go to the Glastonbury Festival to see a music festival in the spring, you're an experiencer. You experience the festival. So that's a bit vague as well. So I use a word abductee. Mm-hmm. An abductee will be typically he or she will be walking down the road, or walking a dog in the countryside, or just strolling through a field, and suddenly they're about 200 meters or 300 meters, I'd say yards, if your audience is predominantly American, ahead of where she was just a second ago. And she looks at her phone or at her watch, and she didn't realize that it was so late. When she was walking, it was like 2:30 in the afternoon. Suddenly it's 4:45, and she says, "Why is the time gone?" She doesn't remember anything about what just happened. She just has a deep feeling that something really strange happened, and she can't make any sense of it. And it's only if she's fortunate enough, or he's fortunate enough, to find out something about this phenomenon, that they can work out what is likely to have happened to them. And in many cases, people don't do that for years. You know, they have two or three incidents that are really odd, really strange, and they only slowly come to the realization that it might be this abduction thing, which nobody wants to be happening to them. Nobody wants to be one of those people, one of those strange people. Right. And so they don't own up to it. They largely bottle it up, and they just shrug it off, and they bury it, and they pretend it doesn't happen in a lot of cases. But eventually, with most abductees that admit that this is actually going on and investigate it and realize that this is going on with them, eventually that they come to the realization, because they have to actively investigate or read up on it or talk to somebody who knows about it, mm-hmm. and put the pieces together and gradually and question themselves and doubt themselves and question what they remember. And eventually they think it must be this, all the questions are answered with this, all the pieces fit together, it must be this. And a lot of people just leave it there and try and get on with their lives. A minority of people like me take it to a very different level and want to investigate this whole phenomenon and what it is and what's behind it. And all the little nuances about it, about what the origin of this thing might be. And, you know, this becomes a fairly major and substantial quest for a significant minority of abductees that admits that this is happening to them.
So do you have any conscious... Now, you mentioned that you spoke with an alien asking him questions. They gave you an answer. But other than that, do you have any conscious recall of any or all of the contact experiences?
I recalled about chapter one of the book is called The Slow Revelation. And in that chapter, I go through a very brief catalogue of standout instances of abduction that I consciously remembered and recalled in enough detail to know that this was really weird, and there's no way what happens to a lot of abductees is something that they often refer to as a trigger event. Mm-hmm. Mine happened when I was 16 years old, and if you've read the prologue of the book, you'll understand. You remember it. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now tell us about that. What happened when you were 16?
Well, it happened in July 2016. I was working in an agricultural rose nursery, which is a big, they grow thousands and thousands and thousands of roses. And we farm them every day and cut them and put buds in them and so forth. And I worked, it was between ending high school and going to a college of further education to do my advanced level studies. And the summer vacation was about 2 months. So throughout late June, whole of July and whole of August, 5 days a week, I went to work in this rose nursery, and I started at 8 o'clock in the morning. So I left home at 7:30 and cycled there because it was a few miles away. And Sunday I also worked because we paid double money. So the only day I didn't go to work, I had one day off a week. It was Saturday. And on Thursday, the 22nd of July, I'll remember this for years and years. I had a very powerful compulsion to get up early on the Saturday morning, like to log it in the diary. And because I was to go somewhere. Now, this sounds a bizarre thing to own up to, and it didn't make any sense to me at the time, but I just felt a very powerful compulsion that on Saturday morning, I'd get up early and go somewhere. And so on the Saturday morning, which is the only day I didn't go to work, I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning, because it was July, it was the 22nd of July. The sun was up by 5 o'clock in the morning at that latitude. And I went out, got dressed and went out the door and quietly shut the door behind me and went. And I walked about maybe a mile and a half to an area where there were some brand new houses in the process of construction. So they had walls and big rectangular holes in the walls where the window frames were to be fitted, but had not yet been fitted, and no doors. And they had some roof timbers and so forth. So they were structurally, some of them were complete, and there were building materials lying around. Because of where it was, there was actually no other residences within about 200 meters, so, which isn't not very far, but it's far enough that if you shouted or you really made a noise, nobody would hear you. Mm-hmm. And I got to this place and I thought, right, okay, now I'm here. Now what? And suddenly everything changed. I remember spectral lights in the blue indigo part of the spectrum pulsating around me and a whooshing sound in my ears. And I remember looking at my watch. I had a wristwatch in those days because this was 1972 and nobody had a cell phone because they didn't exist. And I looked at my wristwatch and I got to this place, I thought, a minute earlier, and it was 5 to 6 in the morning. That's 5:55 in the morning. And my watch said, just after 8 o'clock, it was like, no, I beg your pardon. It was 5:45. It was 5:45. And I looked at my watch and it was 8:05. And I could hear the distant hum of traffic because it was Saturday morning. So that some traffic were moving about at 8 o'clock in the morning. And so I had these pulsating, flashing blue and indigo lights all around me and this whooshing sound in my ears. And somebody is speaking to me in my head from very close by. I couldn't see anybody else. This person said, "You're not going to remember anything about what we've done this morning. All these things we've done, you're going to forget about the whole thing." And I looked through the aperture in the wall, which was where the window frames were to be fitted in this house. So there was a solid brick wall, brand new brick wall, but with an aperture maybe 6-8 feet long and 3 or 4 feet deep, you know, because the window was going to be fitted there. And in my direct view, about 100 meters away, was a flying saucer. Mm. And it was big and it was drifting from left to right across the field of my vision. And it was all these spectral lights flashing and thumping were accompanying this vision and this voice in my head and so forth. And suddenly, bang, everything was back to normal. The craft had gone, disappeared. The spectral lights had gone and the whooshing in my ears had gone. It was still 8:15 by now. Mm-hmm. And I thought, what the hell was that? You know, you would, wouldn't you?
No.
And I thought, I tried to work out where, how this had all happened, because I'd had such a compulsion to get up and go to this place at this specific time and place on that specific morning. And I had all this happen to me. And it, already the memories were kind of fading a bit. But as I walked home, which took about 20 minutes, I suppose, I felt an area on my left cheek, just under the eye socket, which was damp and wet, and it felt hot. And when I looked into the bathroom mirror when I got home, I had a perfectly round coin-sized burn below the eye socket on my left cheek, and it took 3 months to completely heal over. It scabbed over in a way that normally a wound progresses to healing. Yeah. And it took a full 12, 13 weeks to fully heal over. And combined with the compulsion to go to this place on this particular morning, and the memory of a flying saucer and the flashing lights and in the blue lights pulsating around me, and the missing time elements, and the voice in my head telling me I wasn't going to remember anything, all that added together made absolutely no sense to me at all in 1972 in rural England. I could make no sense of it, and I had nowhere to put the experience. What do you do? I think in the United States, the Hill case from 1961 had come into the public domain from 1966 when John Fuller published his book, The Interrupted Journey. So a lot of people in the United States were kind of starting to get familiar with alien abduction was actually a thing that happened, at least to the Hills. But in my world, you know, what I was exposed to in terms of information, there was absolutely nowhere to put this thing at all. But what happened to me, I just didn't know what to do with it. I didn't know where to place it in the catalogue of my life, just nowhere to fit it. So what I had to do is almost pretend it didn't happen, and I hope it didn't happen again. And I thought, if I talk about this, I'm going to be thought a weirdo, or I'm going to be thought to have a psychiatric illness,
right.
Have delusions of some kind. And so I'm not going to talk about it, because I knew basically I wasn't psychotic and I wasn't crazy. I just knew that.
That's how the government and science has been able to keep this hidden in plain sight all these years, right?
Maybe, yeah. I think nowadays, because with the internet, people are far more exposed. They just go to the keyboard and log on and Google alien flying saucer strange experience, and they get 1,000 websites immediately. But in 1972, you couldn't do that because it was prior to the internet's existence. So nobody really had any clue as to what this was in my circumstance.
And you certainly couldn't blame that experience, just like the Hills. Couldn't blame it on sleep paralysis, could you?
Well, exactly. if you wake, fully clothed, walking about in the daylight, in broad daylight, down the street and into a building site, you can't say that you suddenly suffer sleep paralysis, because it's ridiculous. Yes.
I need to take another moment to remind my listeners that you're listening to WHFR.FM, the station making waves. And I'm David Twitchell. You're listening to We Are Not Alone, and we're speaking with Mr. Steve Aspen. Steve is an author and alien experiencer. And let's see. Tell me, Steve, has hypnosis helped with your recall of these events?
Yeah, that's something that I had other experiences that we really don't have time to go into. I'll come back to the core of your question in a minute. But I had other experiences in my 20s and 30s, which led me to eventually realize it was, unfortunately, I thought, this has got to be that. because this thing I've read about. I read Communion in 1987 when Whitley Strieber published it. And I'm actually Whitley's interviewing me next week, actually. So that will be on his Dreamland Network within a couple of weeks.
Very good.
But when Strieber came to launch Communion, he had an extremely effective promotion, a marketing operation, because he was I can't remember the publisher, but I think it's maybe Hampton Roads or something like that. And he went on the chat show circuit in the UK, including primetime chat shows early in the evening and radio shows and on national networks. And the book was in every single bookshop window in London and or every other city. So it was a really big deal. And I read it when he published that in 1987. And I realized that this was a really strange, there's something about the cover image. Obviously you've seen the book and you know it.
Oh, yeah.
Audience will know it as well. There's something about that cover image that sent a chill down my spine. And it wasn't because it was something I recognized. It's very close to what they look like. Not exactly the same, but it's very close to what they look like.
I've heard that from many, many people about Strieber's book.
So there's that. And I was in Sardinia once, and I won't talk about this too long, but I was in a hotel room. And I was staying with my partner at the time, who accompanied me to Sardinia on a business trip. And I went to see a factory making medical devices and so forth, and met with the people. And we stayed in a town called Bosa on the northwest coast of Sardinia. And we got there late at night, and we went to bed really straight away. And I woke up at 7 o'clock in the morning, and I had to drive. The other colleague of mine was from Holland. I had to get him to the airport to get him on a plane back to Amsterdam. And we all overslept for some reason. All of us overslept. And he was in a different room, obviously, to my girlfriend and me. And as I woke up, I was lying on top of the use the word duvet in the United States.
Oh, yeah.
Couch. Couch, yeah, it's a big, fluffy thing that lies on the top of the bedclothes. We call it a duvet, which is a French word. I was lying on top of that with my legs.
What do you call it? A comforter.
A comforter, yeah. And she was fast asleep, completely unconscious, next to me. But she was underneath it, and I was on top of it for some reason. And in the room were two great aliens standing in the room. Right in front of me. And my father was between them. And I talk about what causes them to make you think you've seen your ancestor or relative in this. I give two very detailed explanations about what they do, what this is and why and how they do it. But I thought it was many, many years. I thought this was my dad, who died 3 years earlier after a long illness. And I thought he's coming back to say, I'm fine, I'm okay, Steve, don't worry. Because I was his only son. He had a daughter too. But I thought that was the explanation for it for a long time, this visitation from the grave. But what concerned me was the two bulbous headed, black-eyed grey aliens with the big almond-shaped eyes, one on each side of him. I thought, what are they doing? Who are they? What are they? Do they like these images from the front of the Communion book? So they were standing in the room next to my dad. And it took me a year's... it was another 12 months after this incident. I realized that this was the abduction phenomenon happening to me. This is what it was, because and these gray aliens were right in the room. So I had many, well, not a huge number, but a small number of experiences where I remembered enough to realize that something very, very, very weird was going on, consistently strange was going on. And I didn't start having hypnosis sessions to try and recover the deeper memories until 2008. And then for a couple of years, 2007. And for a couple of years, I worked with two guys who worked for the National Health Service in England, and one in near London, and the second one was in the Northwest. I used to go and see him. And I learned how memory recovery hypnosis works and how it can work and how it doesn't work. People really don't understand. If people have not had a therapy from a good hypnotist, they really can't understand the process, and there is a process to it, and it's not what people think, and you remember things weeks later from trying to recall them. They take that long to emerge into conscious memory, so
it kind of jars the memory. Is that it?
Well, there's a tip of the tongue phenomenon when you're trying to remember somebody's name, or you're trying to remember the name of a book or the name of a town or something, that, you know, you, or the name of a person, actor, you know, whatever it is, you can't quite get it. And you think, you try and remember it, you just give up. Mm-hmm. And then about a day later, you've got it. And it takes that long to work through your conscious and deliver it into your right. conscious mind. Right. So this is how recovering deep seated memories works, but it can take literally 6 or 7 weeks to the memories to come into consciousness, and mm-hmm. you won't remember everything. If you practice the techniques of accessing long-term memory, you can get better at it, and you can have better recall. And a lot of abductees do recall more than they used to because of they've trained themselves to access that part of the mind. So that's occupies most of a chapter in the book, not all of the same chapter, but most. I worked with Professor David Jacobs from Temple University in Philadelphia at the time, between 2010 and 2016. And I'm still in contact with him, even though he's retired from the field now. And he's moved out of Philadelphia, and he lives in a different part of the country. So, but I'm still talking to him.
What do you feel the alien agenda is?
This is the $64,000 question. I speculate about it a little bit in the book, but what I do mostly is lay down the evidence that you can't really argue with. There's a lot of medical evidence because they take little biopsies off the skin, and they're all the same size and shape from abductees. And usually in the areas of the body that the abductee can't see very easily, like the back of their shoulder or the back of the thigh,
right.
But sometimes in more obvious places. And they put implants in. Many of you or your audience will have heard about alien implants. They put implants in to people. A favored site is where the olfactory nerve, the cribriform plate, where the olfactory nerve goes into the brain, that site there, because it's extremely difficult to detect and access.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a 40-page appendix about and the analysis of one of these implants, the chemical analysis of one of these implants. So whatever they're doing, that's a whole subject on its own. You know, that what they, these things have, they're made of biocompatible material, so the body doesn't detect them and doesn't have any inflammatory response. They're the size of tiny cantaloupe seeds or little grains of sand.
Mm-hmm.
And they transmit radio waves in three separate frequencies, and they're inside the core when the material scientist breaks them open. They have these little tiny microscopic carbon nanotubes, which act as receptors and transmitters. So they're very complex, sophisticated devices, and they're made of the metals that their core is made of are non-terrestrial isotopes. If your audience has a your listeners have a any basic scientific education, they'll understand what isotopes are. You know, that they're iron, as an example, has a certain number of neutrons and in its nucleus. A terrestrial iron always has the same number of neutrons, and iron from meteorites, not iron nickel meteorites, which they, you know, they drop out of the sky all over the world, you know, all mm-hmm. the time. Mm-hmm. They have a different number of neutrons in their nucleus. And these little implants are made of non-terrestrial isotopes, which means they originate outside the planet. They don't come from here.
Yeah.
And so I don't know, coming back to your question, I really don't know what they're doing here, but I do know that they have a serious program involving millions of people, which is planning for something. And they're engineering people very quietly, very sophisticated, subtle way to prepare for something. That's all I can say.
The title of your book is Out of Time.
Yes.
To what does that reference?
because I think this has been going on for so long. This program has been going on since 1890 or 1895, and this is the second century we're into now. And I think it's so advanced now that no matter what we do, even if all our governments become aware of it and go public about it, which I think is unlikely for this to ever happen, I think there's nothing we can do now. There were times in this program when we could have stopped it if had the awareness in the population been alerted. We could have done something about it, but it's so subtle, it's so clever, it's so clandestine, and it's so well organized.
Yeah. Even with all the ET's technologies, you know, we could have stopped it in the past?
That's a speculation. I think one of the reasons why I think it was probably possible to intervene and slow it down or stop it is because of their obsession with secrecy. The program is clandestine, and they want to keep it secret for a reason.
Right. They don't feel we could handle it.
I suspect they don't want the program to be interfered with.
Right.
Yeah.
So over the years, now I have interviewed many people from both camps on ET's agenda. David Jacobs and Bud Hopkins always considered them to be nefarious in nature. And on the flip side of that coin, both Whitley Strieber and Kathleen Martin originally considered ETs to be malevolent, but are both... are now on the side of benevolence. So
yeah, I know that's what they think. Yeah.
Yeah. So, in which camp do you find yourself in?
I'm dare I be noncommittal. I'm a bit of a fence sitter. I think the ET presence probably does ultimately have a favorable outcome for the human race, particularly if you consider the way we've been behaving in the last century, and you know, the way we're despoiling the planet and so forth, and polluting everything. And the way UFOs, quote unquote, interfere with nuclear weapons and their delivery systems.
Yeah,
Robert Hastings is a really good friend of mine, and has written the book on this subject, and has researched it for 40 years. Speaking to nearly 200 US Air Force missileers and related personnel about it. So I think that probably won't continue. The manufacture and threat of deploying nuclear weapons.
Okay.
The human race.
You think ET will intervene in that endeavor?
I think there's strong evidence that they do intervene in small ways already, in that they can shut the weapons down and interfere with their delivery systems, and they demonstrate that over and over again. So there probably are benefits, and there probably is a good side. I don't I can't really come down on the side of it's a 100% benevolence, because I just don't know. And the evidence that they want to keep this whole thing a secret and they do not want it in the public domain makes me suspicious that it's not all good news, you know.
Well, they are.
But I may be wrong, you know.
Yeah, they are coming forward with it now. So I think maybe they figure the jig is up. I mean, enough people know about this. It's coming forward. I've always said one day they're going to say, when I say they, our government, our military is going to say, yeah, we have been visited by extraterrestrials in the past and are still being visited. And the general public's going to say, Yeah, I know.
That's the way I felt for 20 years. That's going to happen. And most people say, oh, duh. Yeah, I always knew that. Tell me something I don't know.
Yeah, really?
Yeah.
Because, you know, I think they, I've often been asked, when do you think the truth about UFOs and alien visitation is going to come out? I've always said, when E.T. decides to let
us.
Yes.
Yeah. You know? They will decide when it's
they will indeed decide.
They will decide.
So you think we're out of time here in the...
Yes. There's a couple of other references to out of time in the book that the way that, you know, these crafts shift in and out of dimensions or seem to. Mm-hmm. And they actually look like they're out of time sometimes. So their main motivation behind the title is that what we've just been talking about for a couple of minutes. I think. The main reason behind the choice of the title is what we've been talking about for the past couple of minutes. You know that I think they're nearing the end of their program, and I think times run out to do anything to change it. And we might welcome it, you know, or at least accept what's coming. Eventually, they may not reveal any of everything for 30 or 40 years yet, but they're here in vast numbers doing this vast program in huge numbers of people, covertly, clandestinely, and purposefully. And there's a reason why they're doing this. They're not just doing it for fun.
Well, we may never see that day, but
we may not.
I hope that we can leave this information for our children and grandchildren to deal with. Okay. So where can our listeners go to check out your work?
Okay. Well, if you go to outoftimebook.info, that's outoftimebook, one word. .info. There's a web page where you can see the book and read excerpts from it, and it links to Amazon.com and Amazon.co.uk if you're British. But it's actually available. It's the book is print on demand, and it's available from every Amazon site in the world. Mm-hmm. And it's also available as an ebook. If you buy the ebook, you get all the colors, all the photographs and illustrations and graphs and charts in the back of the book are all obviously all in color, because, you know, e-printing is is easy. And also the links all work right off the page.
Okay. Mr. Steve Aspen, I want to thank you so much for joining us on We Are Not Alone.
Okay. All right, Dave. Thank you. Thank you very much. See you. Yeah. Bye-bye now.
And I want to thank you, the loyal listener. Go to WHFR's homepage and scroll down to We Are Not Alone and click on the headline, which will take you to where you can find my website with all the archived shows. Please join me the first Monday of each month at 2 p.m. when we will again explore the mysteries of the UAP phenomenon. Until then, this is David Twitchell reminding you to keep an eye on the sky.